I'm fairly alive now.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome everybody. And first I will go through the written questions that I've received. The first question is from Marlo. This chapter 8 covers so much to learn and train in. As you say, step by step, the stanzas go about all sorts of emotional and habitual behaviors, mental states, and how this can disturb meditation, like strong attachment or aversion, desire and or hatred, and they offer thus food for contemplative meditation. While listening and going through a whole process here, I discovered a lot about myself, good and bad, and I sort of fell apart in 1,000 pieces and now find ground again. True practice and study and be more on my own except solitude. But through interaction with others, one discovers more about one's mind, habits. So we need our fellow sentient beings along with the sacred Dharma teaching to learn our mind. Isn't that so? Others give us back where we are right or wrong. No? Yes, I think. Yes. I think it is like this. If there are people around you, if there are lots of people or some people, of course, you get lots of opportunities to practice many things with them and also to learn a lot from them. But if you are alone, then also I think there are lots of challenges also, and there are also lots of opportunities to learn from yourself, because basically you have to look at your own mind and you can learn from that. So I think it does not matter whether there are other people or not in order to, you know, learn by yourselves. You can learn anyway, and you can, if you want to learn, if you practice, then you have to do, the practice has to be done on yourself. So, you know, your practice cannot be done by others. So therefore, I think it's up to you, I think, at the end. Next question is from Max Poland. Please, could you explain about Ling Kesarov Ling, who he is and what is his activity and why is he important? Is there a mantra of Kesara one can recite? Please, could you give the mantra, as I would like to connect with Kesara by reciting his mantra, or if there are any short prayers or supplications perhaps. Maybe I could please request you to give the reading transmission of the mantra of Kesara or any other Kesara prayers you think might be appropriate. There are lots of things about Ling Kesara. Kesar of Ling, or was a he happened, or he was born around same time as Milarepa and Machi Labdrin. According to some historical texts, Milarepa, Ling Kesar, and Machi Labdrin were born kind of a year apart. So the eldest was Milarepa, the next year born Ling Kesar, and then Machi Labdrin 1 year younger. So it was around that time. It was the time when the Tibet, you know, the kings of Tibet, the Tibet Empire was was gone to pieces, and Tibet was, you know, had become many different groups of small chieftains and small kings like that. And that time, the Kesar was in east of Tibet. This is the, you know, the exact place where Ling Kesar was born is very near to my place. But there is lots of, legends about him. The epic of Ling Kesar is regarded as the longest epic in the world, because the recorded the books on the chapter on the Ling Kesar epics is said to be about 300 volumes nowadays or something like that. So it's very, very huge. It's long, many stories. But these stories are told by bards, and there's a little bit strange. It's a strange thing, which I think is something quite unique, that there are bards who can tell the story of Ling Kesar just like that. You know, it happens kind of naturally. Some of them cannot even read and write, but they can tell stories, volumes after volumes after volumes, and in very, very good, you know, like poetic Tibetan, and all the conversation is sung in verse, and then, you know, this actual happenings or story is told in prose, in very, very good, you know, very beautiful language and things like that. So it's something a little bit strange. Ling Kesar himself didn't have children, but his brother had, and the, you know, that lineage is still there. It's the king of Ling, my king. And Ling Kesar is regarded as a protector kind of emanation of Guru Padmasambhava. And many Tibetans regard Ling Kesar as a Dharma protector. So they make practices about him and things like that. Of course, there are lots of prayers, short and long, and, you know, lots of them. You know, I can give you some if you want, but I don't know if it's necessary. Of course, there are mantras also. There are a few different mantras. One of them is Om Ahum Mahaguru Mani Ratna Sarva Siddhi Phala Hum. That's one mantra. And I just said it to you. You can consider it a reading transmission if you want. I don't think I'll spend too much time on this today. Next question is from John. And can you please consider the stories of the Bodhisattva ship captain in the Jatakas and the story of the mass murderer Angulimala? What do these teach us about different approaches to reducing harm in the world? The story of the Jataka who became, you can say the ship captain. I don't know if he was really the captain or not, but in the ship, who killed this person called Minak Dontonche, or the kind of a dacoit. That story is about the, the importance of motivation. That story talks about the importance of motivation. Sometimes actions seemingly negative cannot be, can also be very positive. Sometimes actions that are seemingly positive can also be negative, So that depends quite a lot on, the motivation of the person. Because in that story, the Bodhisattva at that time killed this man because he saw that this man was going to kill the captain and all other people in the ship, and he was to, loot. He was to take over the ship, and doing so, he was going to cause lots of, life and, lots of negative, lots of suffering and pain for lots of people. And also, by that action, he would be causing so much negative karma for himself, so that he would be suffering for a long, long, long time. So therefore, this Bodhisattva thought that although it's not that I would not have to carry the negative result of this action, I have to, but I'm ready to do that in order to, stop this person doing those very negative things and causing so much suffering and pain for lots of people, and also lots of suffering for himself in the long run. So therefore, it was a Bodhisattva's action. And although he actually had to go through the karmic results of that killing, but he also, it also was, enhanced his Bodhisattva activity and, was very, very, very proper action of a Bodhisattva too. So that was the understanding. Then the Angulimala story is mainly about, the Buddha's, taught that, anybody who has been not a good person, who has been a negative person, who have done lots of negative actions and things like that, if they want, they can, they can transform, they can change, they can purify. It's not that, if you've done something wrong, then you have to feel completely guilty and, you have to feel lost and, hopeless. You don't have to do that. If you really want, you can purify your negative actions and you can completely transform yourself. That's the story of, that's the main teaching of the Buddha. And that's the story of Angulimala also. Although he, killed 999 people and, was extremely notorious, extremely, you know, negative. But when, you know, Buddha met him and Buddha, you know, talked to him, he could see the reason, and then he changed and he followed the path. He became a monk. He practiced very hard, and so he actually became arhat. Of course, at the end of his life, he was killed by people, you know, who had suffered in his hands. But he died gladly. So this is the, you know, but not only by killing, but any kind of negative actions or negative state of mind you have been, whatever it can be, anything or anybody can be transformed. That's the main teaching here. I think that's so this is the, I think, the main understanding from Buddhist point of view is, you know, anybody who is negative, who has done bad things, we should try to, through kindness, through compassion, through understanding, through dialogue, through teaching, through, you know, every different means, not necessarily, if it's not possible in this life, then in life after life after life, we need to learn, we need to transform them. Just putting somebody, you know, punishing somebody, or just killing somebody, would not solve the problem in the long run. That's the, you know, we must transform them. And in order to transform them, we must educate them, and we must change their way of seeing, their, understanding, and to get rid of their misguidance and, you know, things like that. That's the only way, you know, in the long run, to bring, you know, positive things in the world. Next question is also from John. On recent talks, His Holiness Karmapa recently taught to practice only for future lives. I have many projects in the current life. How do we practice only for future lives? Actually, doing positive things in this life is working for the future life. You know, how do we take care of the future? You know, the idea, the understanding, what the teachings is saying is that, you know, we need to see the long-term benefit as the most important thing. We need to see the benefits of larger sections of the people, you know, like all the sentient beings, the humanity, or, you know, as the more important than, you know, just a few people or just myself and people around me. And the well-being for all the lifetimes in future is more important than just now, you know. So this is the main understanding. But then how do we take care of the future lives, you know? We can't do anything into the future because we are now only, you know. We cannot do anything now in the past because past is not there, it's gone. We cannot do anything in the future because future is not there, it's yet to come. So what we have to do is to, you know, to try to do all good things, positive things, you know, train ourselves, do something that's beneficial and helpful to other people now, you know. That is the way to work for our future lives. That's why His Holiness the Karmapa wrote this book, which is called The Future Is Now. So that's next question is, I think I already talked about the max. Then next question is, another question from Max. In Tibetan medicine, they talk of Nyen diseases. I think these are new diseases such as HIV, Ebola, bird flu, COVID-19, etc., which are appearing at the time of the Kali Yuga. I heard certain wrathful practices like Guru Thakpo or Vajrakilaya are supposed to be good to stop these new diseases. Please could you explain about Nyen diseases and what can be done? Please could you explain, also explain the discord of the Mamus, which they say causes plagues and pandemics? you know, Nyen is more or less, the Nyen disease is actually more about the, you know, like infection. You know, infection diseases that, you know, are infectious diseases. You know, there are many different. It's not a new disease. It's been there all the time. But it is said that, you know, as a prediction, that in future there will be lots of such diseases. Which never was there before, and which doesn't have any known medicines when it comes, and so therefore that's because of people doing negative things and things like that, and so for that then. Different kind of practices and different mantras are recommended and said that if you do these things, and those, some of those diseases which comes in future will be healed or good for them. And this kind of mantras and practices are sometimes discovered in the what we call the Dharma treasure findings, and Mamos, this is this His Holiness Karmapa actually talked about this Mamos when he was doing this practice, and we did also this Mamon Tukong practice called Mamon Tukong, that means to fulfill the discord of the Mamos, or to get rid of the discord of the Mamos. And Mamos is a little bit like the, he described it as more or less like the environment, the globe, which if you look deeply into the of course, there are different Mamos also, outer Mamos, inner Mamos, all kind of different Mamos. But if you look deeply into the teachings, it actually sounds like that too. The next question is Marie. It is said that in our dreams, if we can be aware that we are dreaming, then no emotion will disturb us when the dream turns to be a nightmare. That seems reasonable. But can we really train our minds enough to have full consciousness while sleeping, and how should we work for that? This is, you know, that what we call dream yoga, which is, you know, one of the six yogas of Naropa, and it's not a very easy practice. we have to learn, and you know, we have to practice a lot and things like that. First, we have to learn how to be aware of our dreams. You know, to recognize the dream when we are in the dream. Because unless we do that, then we cannot practice in the dream. So therefore, that's something we have to train actually in the daytime, and also, you know, and there's lots of instructions on that. Once we start to recognize the dream as a dream, then we can use the dream to practice, you know, practice in the dream. We can change the dream, use the dream to, you know, to do lots of different things. His Holiness Karmapa, recently when he was talking, teaching about the eighth Karmapa, he gave a story, I think, about one of the Karmapas, that he was so good at dream yoga that before, you know, before he was going to bed, he used to keep like lots of books open, 15, you know, 20 books open, and then he used to go to sleep. And then in the morning when he got up, he would have, you know, he would have read through all these books, because in dream he kind of emanated into many people, many beings, and then each one went through one of the volumes and kind of read all the books, and many other things like that. So, you know, so this is when you are extremely good in dream yoga. So, you know, it's not an easy practice. So, I think that's the end of the written questions. There's any other questions?
Yeah, Rinchen, right?
So I can't see Rinchen.
I'm here.
How do I go? Oh, yes, I have to go here. Just a moment. Gallery. Okay. Okay, now I can. Yes. Yes.
Can you see me?
Yes, now I can see.
Okay. And
I am so used to doing, you know, putting it on the screen, because I was always using iPad for. So now I have this, you know, laptop. So I was still using it on my screen, which doesn't work.
Anyway, nice to see you, and happy Easter.
Oh, same to you, all of you.
Are you in Siliguri?
No, I am in Gentong now.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have a question for you, but in a way, to some extent, to a large extent, you've covered it with John's questions.
Okay.
Maybe I could just go quickly, and you could make a quick comment.
Okay.
I'm talking, questioning you about sutras that seem to contradict each other,
mm-hmm.
or teaching seem to, maybe on the first look at them. And you were saying, I think, in your talk on the Four Immeasurables last Saturday, nobody knows what will happen after death. And I read a teaching fairly recently. The fellow was saying, I don't know who it was, a monk, haven't got it with me, that if you take the life of a single being, then you will go to the hell realm for Kalpas.
If you do what?
He said, if you were to take the life of any single being, you will go to the hell realm. Then, backing that up a little bit, maybe slightly different. Shantideva, on chapter on patience, says, all the good works gathered in 1,000 ages, such as deeds of generosity, offerings for the blissful ones, a simple flash of anger shatters them. So that's one view, but then this is a, I prefer, from Kistigarbha Sutra. And here Shakyamuni is talking to Kistigarbha and says, if any beings have karma...
Yeah.
If in future, if any beings have karma that bring them into hell and can remember the name of one Buddha or one Bodhisattva, or one passage, or even one sentence from the Mahayana Sutra, when they reach the gate of hell, then through your supernatural powers, you should lead beings out of their sufferings. Show them your various transformations and bring them to salvation to enjoy supreme bliss.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, you know, the one view seems very thick. You know, you've done some mistake and that's it, and yet this one seems very gentle. It's the words of a bodhisattva, that just to remember one phrase from the Buddha's teaching is enough to transform yourself even when you're facing the gates of hell.
Yeah, this is you have to see the whole thing together, you know. The first, you know, If you did something very wrong, it has its very, very negative or very strong negative effects. That's first thing. If you do something right, or if you transform it or purify it, it is possible to purify it. Yeah.
Yes.
So, you know, that's the kind of the message, and this has to be put, you know, in the right what can you say, right context. Otherwise, you know, if you just take one thing and then take it as the only way, in the same sutra, which says that, you know, if you kill somebody, then you will go to hell continuously. There will be also teaching saying that, you know, if you do this good thing, then you will be liberated from all the time, you know. So there is, you know, this thing is very important to understand in the context, and to get put together. Yeah. So I think it is important to understand, like, this section in Bodhichaya Avatara is also, you know, there are lots of commentaries and lots of actually debates also on this, because, you know, in the most of the, you know, Mahayana teachings, especially the, you know, from the Nalanda, it's a, you know, even the Buddha's teachings are examined, and, you know, there could be Tangdun and Ngedun, you know. There are teachings which are what we call Tangdun, which is like Tangdun means like leading meaning. Another is Ngedun, is like definitive meaning. So leading meaning is that it's said, the Buddha said it, but it is said for a purpose, you know, for that particular person at that time, or something like that, which is true in some sense, but not complete true, you know. So there are lots of teachings like that. Like, for instance, you know, if you say this mantra once, all the negative karma of you for like countless kalpas will be totally finished. this is same as like if you did one negative, you know, one anger, then all your positive thing will go away. You know, it's similar. So, you know, it's in a way true, you know, because like if you are really very, very angry, and you know, if you are totally taken over by hatred, and you can do something that will banish all your positive things that you did all your life, no? You can do so much destructive things if you are completely taken over by your hatred, you know? You can kill lots of people, you can destroy lots of things, you can destroy your own self and things like that. So therefore you have to be extremely careful about, you know, managing your mind, your anger, your emotions and things. That's the main understanding. So, you know, this is something that we have to understand in the whole.
Thanks, Rinpoche. In fact, in Kistigarbha Sutra before this, there's a lot about going into hell and all the different...
Yes, yes, yes. I think it's in a way true that, you know, I see it like this, that, you know, we can create hell for ourselves very easily, you know. If we are too much, if you react with only anger and jealousy and, you know, ego and, you know, aversion and attachment and greed, we can create hell for ourselves and also for people around us, no? But at the same time, if we really did with kindness, compassion and generosity, then we can also create like a heaven for ourselves, you know. And so this is, you know, it's not something that is, you know, the hell and heaven are not so, you know, totally far away and totally something, out of, you know, reach. It is something that is within our reach and that we can create. So if we understand this and then try to, you know, work with that understanding, then I think we can understand these things a little bit more clearly, and we don't have to take everything too literally also.
Thanks, Rinpoche.
Thank you. Who is the next?
Hello, Rinpoche.
Hello.
Hello. Please live a long life.
Okay, if I can.
I'm reciting your long life prayer.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But I have a question.
Yes.
Also, Karmapa mentioned also about Nikyo Doji teaching Rangsong and view. And I was thinking about it a long time, like what is Rangsong view and Shensong view? I understand it's like self-empty and other-empty, but I don't know what it means. If it says self-empty, I kind of understand, I think, but I'm not sure. Because if you can look in yourself and see some kind of being that being empty. But order empty, I don't know what is empty like that way. And I thought maybe you can explain it.
Well, it's... In one way, it's very complicated. It's just... it's actually a little bit two way of looking at things, yeah? Two way of looking at things. One is that you you look at self, you know, rang tong, self is not me. Self is like by itself, yeah? Self is by itself. So rang tong is like, view is that if you look at anything, like, you know, look at this object, this house, this world, this person, you know, this mind, anything, you know, then you analyze that, and when you analyze that, you don't find anything there existing, you know, independently, and one anything, you know, you can never find anything that is truly existing on its own. So therefore, it's interdependent, it's impermanent, it's changing, you know. It's empty in its nature. So everything is empty in its nature. That's the understanding of rang tong. The yen tong is not looking at things from, you know, as if I am analyzing it, but looking at the experience of that being, yeah. So, like, when somebody who has, like, Buddha or anybody who has had the experience of enlightenment, yeah. So there, that experience, you know. Now, there is nothing called, this is empty of anything, because, you know, there is, it's experience. That experience is completely joyful, completely, like, almost eternal, you know. There is nothing to... You can't say it's empty or not empty. It's beyond empty and not empty, beyond any concept anyway. Completely, you know, free, enlightened, completely awake, and, you know. So therefore, there's nothing empty in a way, you know. So empty of all the concepts, but nothing empty of its own, because it's the experience of perfection. So the, you know, that is the Yentong view. You know, it's not, you know, there's nothing empty of itself in a way. Of course, it's, you know, if you look from the Rang Tong point of view, it's empty. But in the experience itself, there's nothing called empty or unempty. So that's a Yentong view, and you can have so much debate on that, but actually it's talking about the same thing, just from two different angles. So actually it's not necessary to debate at all. It's just talking about the same thing.
So when it says other empty, you know, then from, does it mean there is no separation between self and other?
Everything is empty of our misunderstanding or our concept and our, you know.
So our concepts are other than our true self.
Well, when you say our, then we are empty of ourness.
I was thinking, when you experience very strong emotion, then really, you know, strong attachment and strong anger.
For that, there is no difference. There is no difference whether you are. You know, it's just two different ways of explaining. You know, emotions are something that we have to work with, whether you follow the, you know, whichever philosophy that is. That's another thing.
I've not.
Yeah.
I think so much. but oh yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Hello, Bernard. You have to, yes.
No, I've got it.
Yes. How are you?
Thank you. Best greetings from Berlin.
Okay.
I'm a little bit nervous because it's the first time that I try this Zoom stuff.
Okay. It's not so difficult when you are used to it.
Now, I should have, I'm interested in do another discussion about Rangtung and Shantung, but I'm prepared for another question.
Okay. Now, okay.
Because this Rangtung question is interesting for me too. Now, I'm just preparing a little teaching about the three immeasurables.
Three what?
And the three immeasurables.
Okay.
The four immeasurables. Three. The four. Three. Dharma mudras.
Okay.
Anitya, so non-ego and nirvana.
Okay.
So non-durance of phenomena.
Okay.
Third thing. The first is non-objective, I think, or in English. Has no, doesn't need time, no, it's not objectively, was die erste. In Sanskrit is Anitya.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So my question is, when it has no room, no time, because it's present, does it exist? Does the phenomena exist in no time, in a kind of no time? Because if there is no space there from beginning to the end, what is left then? Do they happen in no time? Pop up in no time and hot. So this that coming and going is collapsing. The beginning and the end of the phenomena is collapsing in no time. Is that correct?
I think it is talking about, you know, the time, like, first, you know, everything is impermanent. That's anitya, yeah? Is impermanent. Impermanent. Because, you know, anything that is there is made of so many different causes and conditions. It's not one thing. And so many of these causes and conditions, each of them are made of lots of causes and conditions. And there's nothing totally one. And because everything is so many and interdependent, that it has to change. It has to change all the time, and it has to change all the, you know, every part and things like that. So therefore, there is nothing remains the same, you know, even for one moment. That's the anitya. Now, you know, that's why, because everything changes all the time, and because there is nothing, because everything changes all the time, so therefore there is nothing that exists totally on its own, because
yes,
everything changes all the time. So when you, if you talk about the time is a relative thing, you know. Time, there is nothing called time. We just, you know,
yes,
we call time, we conceive things through time. Because we said, you know, this is now. So now is present. And then kind of present time is a relative term, because, you know, this present time is before that is past and after that is future, so therefore it's present. But if you try to find exactly the present time, we cannot find it, because there's nothing called present time, because it's always, you know, changing. And so therefore there is nothing called present time that we can hold on to. So therefore the time itself is a relative term. It's not there, because past is not there. It's gone. It's always gone. It's never there. Future is never there, because it's always to come, not yet there, because otherwise it will be not the future. So there is no future. Future is, not there. Present also, if you look very minutely, it's not there, because this moment it's gone and this moment is yet to come. So, you know, there is nothing called present. So therefore, you know, if you look deeply, everything is like that. Everything is like that. Not only past and present, but you and me, and, you know, good and bad, and right and wrong, and, you know, everything is a little bit like that. You know, that's the how things really are. But then it appears, you know, everything appears like a, you know, like illusion, like a dream. You know, and then, and that doesn't need something to be there, you know, as a, you know, because this is the most of us, or most of the people think that if something is appearing, if something is happening, then there should be something which truly exists. But from the Buddhist point of view, actually, there cannot be something truly existing. Otherwise, the things cannot be so vibrant, and cannot be so much, many things can happen, and it can change so much. If it was something that was only truly existing something, because if truly existing something, then it cannot change, because it exists on its own. So if it exists on its own, then it has to be something more concrete and more independent, and then it cannot, you know, it cannot be affected by everything, and it cannot affect everything, so therefore it cannot change. So the fact that everything is happening and everything is changing and everything is blooming and everything is developing and everything is growing and dying and things like that is the actually proof that nothing is existing on its own, but they are all arising, you know, interdependently, and, you know, so that's the way how everything exists. But we don't see it, and we think everything, you know, anything or I or others or everything exists as something totally existing on its own, and then we are very much attached to it, or we have something great aversion to it, and then, you know, it, you know, we have lots of problems because of that, because, you know, the things that we are attached to goes away, and then we are totally devastated, and then something that we have aversion to also comes and even becomes more, or, you know, everything, and then we are lots of, you know, suffering and pain and problems, and so this is because of our way of reacting to the whole situation. And so therefore, if we understand the way how things really are, that could a little bit change our way of seeing things and the way of reacting to things. We could very much love, we could very much have compassion, we could be, you know, help each other, but we don't have to be reacting with too much, you know, attachment and too much aversion, but, you know, let things be more, you know, as it comes. So that's the idea.
Thank you very much. That's very constructive. Another question, which also concerns it, is this view of the world and this view of the conventional reality, which the Buddha discovered, is that the only difference to the other Indian philosophers?
There are lots of shades of differences, and, you know, there are lots of slightly different ways of putting it, even among the Buddhist scholars, you know. So therefore, the saying, you know, if two scholars agree, one is not a scholar. So there are lots of differences, you know, you can explain, and that's why, you know, the Zhentong and the Rangdong and all kind of other things, you know. There are many different Rangdong philosophers, and there are many Zhentong philosophers who are, you know, always debating, and among Buddhists also, you know, it's like that. So there's no, yes, no two great two philosophers who would totally agree on everything.
Yes, at the end I would recite a little bit for Trungpa about that. Shigeru Trungpa said that we intend to live in a crystal world. You fear the flow,
yeah,
he said.
Yes, that's it.
The reason why we are so suffering.
Yeah, right.
I thank you very much. It gives me more clearness.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Anybody else?
No more waiting now.
Okay. I think then we can maybe stop here. Thank you so much. And all the best. Very good Easter Sunday. And I hope you had very nice eggs. I'm sorry I couldn't get any Easter eggs this year. Hopefully I will eat lots of Easter eggs next year. Thank you so much. All the best.